And a previous program was Take Charge of Your Health with Kareem Fenari, heard every Friday starting at 1 p.m. here on WBAI. Now stay tuned for Nonfiction with Harry Allen. And this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. It is now 2 p.m. Stay tuned.
I'm Harry Allen. This is Nonfiction. On this edition of Nonfiction, they are questions and conundrums so profound that they are often hard to even get one's mind around. Some require mathematical calculations that would take millennia, but we don't have that much time. So we're going to be discussing some of these all on this edition of Nonfiction.
Clouds in my coffee and you're so
And it's 5 minutes after two here on Nonfiction, the magazine of the arts, ideas, and fact. It's Friday, the 20th of March, 2015. And my name is Harry Allen. And we just heard from Carly Simon from her 1972 No Secrets album on the Elektra label. And that song is titled You're So Vain. It's her signature song and relevant for a reason we'll be discussing, appropriate, a little bit later in our broadcast. And as we said at the outset, today we're going to be talking about questions and puzzles and conundrums, but not knock-knock jokes and things of that nature. We're going to be talking about philosophical, mathematical, computational issues that really lie on the edge of reason. You might say the outer limits of the same. And in fact, the book that will be our guide is called just that, The Outer Limits of Reason, What Science, Mathematics, and Logic Cannot Tell Us. It's by Nussan Yanofsky, and he is our guest today here on Nonfiction and on WBAI. Dr. Yanofsky is a professor here in New York City. He teaches in the Department of Computer and Information Science at Brooklyn College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and he's a co-author of Quantum Computing for Computer Scientists. And this is his new book on MIT Press, or I should say the MIT Press, as they refer to themselves. Quite a book, quite an incredible book. A book that, like a lot of the issues, because it's presenting these issues, can sometimes be difficult to get your head around. These are not just mind benders, but these are kind of like mind, I don't know what you'd say, like mind breakers often.
Mind expanders.
Certainly mind expanders, I'd say that. But Dr. Yanofsky, Nussan is our guest today here on Nonfiction. Welcome to Nonfiction and to WBAI.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for having me here.
And what is this book about?
This book is about, throughout your education, you learn what science and what math can do and how you can calculate different things and do things. And this book is a compendium, a list of many things that you can't, that science cannot do and math cannot do, and philosophical questions that not we're not smart enough at the moment, but there are no answers to such questions. And so I'm very much interested in seeing what the limits of science are and what the limits of mathematics is and what the limits of computers are.
And that's what you treat in this book.
Exactly.
Why did you write it?
Well, I wrote it because I was interested in it. I also wrote it because I teach some of the stuff in computer classes. So, for example, one of the results I teach is a result by Alan Turing, who's famous for this the movie that just came out called The Imitation Game.
Yes.
And he showed,
played by Benedict Cumberbatch.
Right.
Yes.
You can pronounce his name.
Yeah, it's one of those names, right?
Right. And he showed in the 30s, long before there were ever computers, he showed what computers cannot do. And so I got interested in this, and I...
And when you say what he showed what computers cannot do, you mean, and this is not related to how fast a computer is,
right,
how much memory it has, or anything like that.
Right. So he showed that there are certain questions, and we can get into this later on, mm-hmm. There are certain questions that... And they're objective questions. They're not questions like, is this painting beautiful or should I do this moral act or something like that, which, people can argue back and forth. They're objective questions that have yes, no answers, and yet computers cannot figure them out. Mm-hmm. And so this is an amazing thing. In the 30s, before the engineers had figured out how to build computers, and before what was portrayed in the movie, where he saved Western civilization by beating the Nazis, or helping beating the Nazis, before this, in the 30s, he showed what computers cannot do. Mm. And so you have this idea of limitation, of the outer limits of, computers might be able to do this, and they can do this, and they can do that. And we live in a world dominated by computers, and we see what computers can do all the time. But it's very interesting in seeing what they cannot do. Anyways, so the purpose of writing this book was to take these things, and there were other things when I was writing my book on quantum computing, so I had to learn a lot about quantum mechanics. And there also, there's limitations. There's things that we cannot, that quantum mechanics tells us that we cannot know, uncertainty in some sense. So I was very interested in all these different areas, and I was trying to put them together and somehow categorize them and see how they interact and things like that.
And to your credit, as I said, these are mind-opening. I say mind-breaking questions sometimes. But you've treated them with illustrations and with analogies that help people get a grasp on it. You also present the math in many cases and the computations themselves, but you tend to kind of lead the reader into it.
Right. Well, I wrote this book. I teach a class based on this book, while writing this book, I was teaching a class based on it. And it's a class for non-science majors at Brooklyn College called Paradoxes and the Limits of Reason. And I wrote this
book. Great title, by the way.
Thank you. I wrote this book with them in mind, and not only them in mind, they were helping me edit it. In other words, I would write a chapter and I would hand it out to the students and they would hand it back. No, I didn't understand this. Make this more understandable. I need a picture here. We need a picture there. So this wasn't a solo thing. The students were helping me, and again, the goal is total clarity. I'm not trying to, you know, blow away people. I'm bringing in many different concepts, but I want to be understandable, and the students wouldn't let me be otherwise.
Oh.
They were having fun doing it.
At their best, students can help you keep you honest, for sure.
Right, right. And also, they're great at picking up typos.
We're speaking with Nussin Yanofsky. He is a professor at Brooklyn College and author of a new book. It's called The Outer Limits of Reason, What Science, Mathematics, and Logic Cannot Tell Us. And it's on the MIT Press. And now, as you said, and I agree, I think it's safe to say that most people, including many scientists, believe that given the speed and voraciousness with which science acquires new information and uncovers new truths, that ultimately nothing is beyond its reach. In other words, we don't know everything, but we are making rapid progress in questions to which we do not know the answers. Today, we can be assured that we will know these answers tomorrow. However, you would say, you would say that such questions are not the focus of this book.
The focus
of this book, instead, are those questions that by their very nature are irresolvable, that cannot be answered. You say even if one had a computer 1 trillion times faster than the fastest computer ever made and ran it continuously for a trillion, trillion centuries, it would be unable to answer some of these questions.
Right.
These questions are scientific, they're mathematical, and they're logical in nature. That is, they exist and have their primary import in fields of science, math, and logic. And further, your book is divided into 10 chapters. An introduction, then, language paradoxes, philosophical conundrums, infinity puzzles, computing complexities, computing impossibilities.
That's where Turing is.
Turing, yes. Scientific limitations, meta-scientific perplexities, mathematical obstructions, and then the last, beyond reason. So I'd like to pull at least one example from some of these chapters as we go through the book and try to understand your ideas. But before we do, I'd like to ask you about a statement in the book. And in fact, it's your very first statement. It says, "With understanding comes ambivalence." Most people would think that with understanding comes certainty, but you say something opposing. And I sense that this difference between what most say and what you do is kind of at the heart of what your book is about.
I agree. All academics, we get bored of things after a while. You know, once we understand something, we want to go on to something else. Okay, and so what this book is, the reason why this book is for me so exciting is because I'm not doing. We're not talking about things in which the answers are given. We're talking about things for which we cannot find answers, and which there are answers, but for the following reason we can't do it. So, in some sense, we'll never get bored because, you know, we'll never know this perfectly. You know, so let's say you're trying to learn a programming, a certain program. And so once you got it, okay, you're bored with it. You're thinking about getting another one. And you've mastered your iPhone 6 and immediately Apple comes out with an iPhone 7 and you got to work on that. So in that sense, you know, we're ambivalent by it. We, you know, the stuff that we know, we're bored with it and we move on. But the stuff that we can't, we don't know, we're excited and interested. Mm. And then the stuff that we can't go is even more interesting.
Mm.
But I want to just stress one thing. In no way is this book an anti-science book. This book is a purely popular science book. It's not making fun of science. It's not denigrating science that it can't answer these questions. In fact, every result here is a scientific result. It's science telling us that this can't be done. In other words, science has advanced to the point where it can see its own boundaries, where it can see, oh, you know, we can do this, we can do this, we can do that, but we won't be able to do this.
Is this book anti-scientism?
No.
That is to say, the idea that all that is worth knowing is delivered through science.
I don't know. Does anybody believe that? I mean, that's a hard, you know. Well, I don't know. I wouldn't say it's anti-scientism. There are certain things that we believe that we, you know, we love our spouses. It's not a scientific statement, and yet it's an important thing. We love our children. We enjoy certain paintings. There are certain things that we know, you know, is a beautiful painting,
yes,
even though science doesn't tell us that.
Yes.
So I don't know if anybody really believes, you know, in that definition of scientism.
And part of the reason I'm asking is because there are some of these questions that people believe, even if they can't prove it, are the domain of the divine. Some of the issues that this book touches on. And you even mentioned, especially in the Beyond Reason section, you raised the question of divinity or God as it pertains to some issues.
Right. So religion gets in this area. In other words, this is not a religious book, and it's not meant to be a religious book, and I mention it only because, you know, obviously there are some obvious questions. But, you know, in the fourth chapter of Genesis, you know, God tells Adam and Eve, you can eat from any one of the trees except the tree of knowledge. And in some sense, you know, there's a feeling there of God trying to hold man back from knowing certain things. And religion plays on this, but yeah, religion has this, but I don't get into that area. And I mean, obviously, anybody interested in the relationship between religion and science has to read this book and, you know, deal with these concepts here. But I don't get far into that.
It's not as much your focus.
It's not my focus. My focus is to present these results, and of course, you know, these ideas have to be dealt with by anybody in religion and in science. But no, it's not my focus.
Well, begin where you begin, and I think this is probably an area that probably comes to, it's probably the first thing that even in grade school, if you're coming across this kind of information, you might trip over some of it or might be presented to you, and that is language paradoxes.
Right.
And you present, for example, what's commonly known as the liar's paradox, and you also speak about the barber paradox. Let's talk about those two briefly.
Well, so it's an ancient paradox, and it goes back to a guy who lived in Crete. His name was Epimenides, and one day he was a cantankerous, argumentative person, and he says, he didn't like his neighbors, right? So he, you know, picked up his window, looked out his window, and said, all Cretans are liars. And the problem with that is that he's a Cretan also. He's from Crete also. And so he's a liar, and his statement is a liar. And so then, is he saying the truth or is he not?
Right. So the question is, he's a Cretan, says all Cretans are liars. So if he's a Cretan, and he's saying all Cretans are liars, does that mean he's a liar? And if he's a liar, that means that not all Cretans are liars.
Right.
But if not all Cretans are liars, that means
he could be
he's lying.
Right.
So it's a kind of thing that,
if it's true, it's not true. If it's not true, it's true.
Right.
Okay. But the main point of this is that what's going on there? When you make an English sentence, you know, here we are at WBAI, you're making a statement about where we are. You're making a statement about that. But you can also make a statement about another statement, you know, what I said, well, you know.
What I said before didn't matter.
What you said before didn't matter. Okay, so that's a statement making a statement about another English statement, okay? But what Epimenides was doing was he was making a statement about his own statement. So this is an amazing fact about language. Language can talk about itself. Okay, and in a shorter version of the Epimenides paradox is the liar paradox. Basically, the English sentence: this sentence is false. Let's go through it. If it's true, it's false, and if it's false, it's true. So. Because
if it's true, then it becomes false again.
Right.
So it keeps vibrating.
It keeps vibrating, and it's neither true nor false, because if you say it's true, then what does it say? It says it's false. It must be false. And if you say it's false, this sentence is false, that means it's true. So you get back and forth. And where did you get what was the problem here? The problem is with this self-reference. You have English sentences talking about English sentences, and that gives you trouble. Okay? Now, a lot of times throughout this book, you're going to have this self-reference pop up over and over again. And in some sense, it gives you a boundary saying, hey, you know, is it true or is it false? Did it happen? Did it not happen? And you can do this over and over. This happens over and over throughout the book.
In computing, does self-reference invoke what's called a loop?
No, not really. In computing, let's talk about computing. In computing, self-reference invokes something called an operating system. So you have, what's an operating system? It's a program that deals with a program, deals with other programs. Well, in some sense, you have that type of problem. When you have computers dealing with computers, you have self-reference. And you can get into trouble.
This is part of the reason we played Carly Simon's song, You're right. So Vain, at the opening of the show. Say why, please.
Right. Well, it's just in popular culture, it's an example of a self-referential thing. She's singing a song, and she's saying, you're so vain, you probably think this song is about you. And she's supposedly talking about somebody. It doesn't matter. But the point is, it is talking about him. Okay, so it's a song about a song, and it's talking about a person, and it all gets, you know, confused inside there. But here's the main point. We all live with it. We all live with self-reference all the time. It doesn't bother us. For example, you can say, never again. I will never, you know, never again. Well, you never say never again. Well, I just did. So you have this self-reference.
That was even for James Bond film.
Right. Yeah. So you have this self-reference all the time, and we live with it without a problem. Now, all those things are in language. Self-reference shows up in language a lot. But what the book shows is it shows up in computers. It shows up in math. It shows up in science. It shows up all over. And you get... So it's this common theme of self-reference is an example of where these limitations show up.
So why does self-reference invoke paradox in all these areas?
Because a paradox is something that if you start off assuming something, you get into a contradiction. And contradiction is something where you can prove something is both true and false. Now, we don't like contradictions. Contradictions don't exist in the physical world. A fact is either true or it's not true or it's false. And there's nothing that's both true and false. And so whenever we see something that's both true and false, we know we made a bad assumption. So if you assume that every English sentence about something is either true or false, you made a contradiction. That's an assumption, and that assumption is wrong. Why? Because the sentence, this sentence is false, is neither true nor false. It's about something. It's about that English sentence. But it's neither true nor false. So the point is, whenever you have this ability to have self-reference, you have an ability to have a paradox, and you have this limitation comes in.
People often talk about how in time travel is first of all the question of can it happen, but then there's also the question of if it were possible, it would possibly create paradoxes. So, for example, a person could get in the time machine, go back in time, and kill their grandfather. Or the very popular film, Back to the Future, is about a guy going back in time who has to make sure his parents meet so that he is born. But these are paradoxical kind of situations, because it's almost like it's inevitable that his parents meet no matter what he does, because he exists. The fact that he is even going back in time means he was successful. Or right. Does it?
Right. So, but again, there's this self-reference. The point there is, in the movie, he goes out of existence.
Yes, he's actually starting to.
Siblings are going out of existence. And this other classic film, Time Travel Hot Tub, which is...
Hot Tub Time Machine. Yes.
It's a classic movie.
It must be, because they just made a second one.
Right, it's an important movie.
Yes, indeed.
It's the Citizen Kane of the...
of time travel movies.
Well, three-quarters of science fiction movies are about, just to have time travel. And there they have the paradox. The idea is as follows. Let's say I drop my key, keys. So that's an event, right? Now, what's going to happen when you drop your keys? They're going to fall to the floor. That's another event. So you have one event affecting another event. Now, what you have with time travel, if it was possible, was an event affecting itself. So like you said,
yes. If
the man goes back in time and kills his bachelor grandfather, before he has children, right? So then that man will not...
The time traveler will never exist.
Right. So if he kills his bachelor grandfather, then his father won't exist, then he won't exist. So by killing his bachelor grandfather, he makes sure that he cannot kill his bachelor grandfather. Because if he kills him, then his grandfather won't be there anymore, his father won't exist, and he won't exist. Okay, so you have... And by the way, one shouldn't get so violent, don't kill your bachelor grandfather, it's just wrong. But you can do it even much simpler, namely, go back in time 2 minutes. Go into the time machine, go back in time 2 minutes, and then go back in time 2 minutes while you're standing there going back there, so there's going to be two copies of you, and just hold your future self from going into the time travel machine. If you restrict your future self from going into the time travel machine, then he won't be able to go back in time. So you're in some sense killing yourself. If you hold your future self from coming back, whatever, you're killing yourself and not letting yourself go in. And if you're not letting yourself go into the time travel machine, well, then you won't exist to hold your future self back.
This is the self-reference that keeps popping up.
It's the self-reference. So here we have not language talking about language, but physical events affecting themselves negatively.
We're speaking with Dr. Nussin Yanofsky. He's the author of a new book, The Outer Limits of Reason. If you're holding on to grasp all this, stay with us. It gets even weirder. This is Nonfiction. My name is Harry Allen. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back right after this.
Hi, this is Eric Anderson.
This is Rosie Perez.
You're tuned to WBAI.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen? This is LL Cool J.
This is Dave Marsh.
Hi, this is Tony Bennett.
Hi, this is Julie Cruz from New York City, and you're listening to
WBAI FM.
The soundtrack of New York City.
Non-commercial and with no additives. We're listener-supported.
I don't listen to the radio.
I don't like stuff that sucks.
You talking to me?
I love this radio station.
You talking to me?
Nothing good could come from this. Can we pull back and take it slow? The breathless fall toward a kiss. Head over heels before you know. All desire, all the draw, all the newness of it all. It's a tumble, it's a twist. It's getting harder to resist. But nothing good can come from this. Nothing safe here, nothing sound. And keep the train along the track. There's still time to turn around. As if we don't know turning back. Or kick wide open that same door. Just like I've always done. It's a tiny little town, and there's too much here to risk. Nothing good can come from this. price of alcohol. Just another thing to miss, another ghost upon my lips, another taste I can't resist. The breathless fall toward a kiss. Nothing good can come from this.
It's 2:31 in the afternoon here on Nonfiction, the magazine of the arts, ideas, and fact. And we just heard from Amy Spies, perhaps continuing our self-referential theme here today. Her track is called Nothing Good Can Come From This, and it's on her new album, That Kind of Girl, on the Windbone Records label. And Amy Spies is going to be here in New York. She's going to be performing Sunday, April 5th, and Tuesday, April 7th, at the Living Room at 134 Metropolitan Avenue in Brooklyn. That's 9 p.m. on April 5th, and time to be announced on April 7th, but it'll be in the evening, no doubt, certainly. And then on Monday, April 6th, at 7 p.m., she'll be at Rockwood Music Hall. That's at 196 Allen Street here in New York City. Amy Spies, that's S-P-E-A-C-E. That's the word peace with an S in front of it. Amy Spies, Nothing Good Can Come From This on her That Kind of Girl album, and we are speaking today about puzzles and conundrums and phenomena, typically self-referential phenomena, like the statement, I am lying. That's a self-referential kind of statement. So if I'm lying, does that mean I'm telling the truth? But if I'm telling the truth, that means I'm not lying. These kinds of ideas, these kinds of systems are all throughout the universe, and they form, you might say, to a great degree, the backbone of the problems that Dr. Nassim Yanofsky attacks in his new book, The Outer Limits of Reason, What Science, Mathematics, and Logic Cannot Tell Us. Many of us think that we can logically know or scientifically know or mathematically know all kinds of things, but it turns out that there are many classes, if you will, of phenomena that are unresolvable by these means. Chapter 3 in your book is one that you say you've been getting a lot of email about. That mm-hmm. People have been writing about your book and all aspects of it, but Chapter 3 is really provocative. And you also made the point before we were talking that Chapter 3 contains the Ship of Theseus problem, which is something I mentioned. I'm trying to remember why I brought it up on my radio show a few weeks ago, but something that I learned about some time ago, rather recently, in fact, maybe a couple of years ago, and I find very, very compelling. And it seems like it connects to a lot of questions that that I've had about, well, I don't know what class of a problem this is, but tell us what the Ship of Theseus is.
So it's a classic, I mean, by classic, I mean 2,500 years old problem that philosophers have talked about. And it's the problem of identity, namely as follows. There used to be a general, his name was Theseus, and he united Greece in one, to make it into one state in some sense. And then when he died, they made a memorial for him, namely they took his ship and they placed it in Athens and they left it there. We do the same thing. The Intrepid downtown is a memorial. And in Boston, they have the USS Constitution. It's an old wooden ship that's there. Okay, so, but they had the ship there for hundreds of years. Okay, and the idea is as follows. It's a wooden ship in salt water, and so at some point the planks rot away. So if you take off a plank and you change the plank, you want to keep the memorial going, so you change the plank. Question.
As one plank rots, you replace it with a new plank that fits perfectly in.
Right. Okay, so question. Is it now the same ship as it was before?
Is it still the Ship of Theseus after you've replaced all the planks?
Well, even if you make one change.
Or just one change, right.
I mean, after all, Theseus didn't see this plank. Well, he didn't touch this plank. Why is this called Theseus' ship when this is not his? And let's say you do something else. Let's say instead of, you know, having it made out of wood, you decide to make it out of plastic, one of the planks. Okay, so that's another change that you can make. Now, the amazing thing is that when you teach this and when you present this to people, people get violently sure about some of the answers. but in opposing views. So, you know, one student would say, no, you made a change, it's no longer Theseus's ship. And another student would say, no, you know, you change your tire in your car, it's still the same car. And so you go on back and forth.
Good
about
point.
That. You change your air conditioner in your house, it's still the same house. But Theseus's ship is a series of questions about the ship, but more about everything. So, you know, let's say you change. Let's say the ship is made out of 100 planks. Let's say you change 51 of the planks. Now, even if you thought that, you know, you change one, it's still the same. In what way is it still the same? Now,
yes, is that the same boat that Theseus was on?
Right. And again, if the ship was there for hundreds of years, eventually they changed every one of the planks. Okay, is it still his or is it not? And the answer is, well, it depends on the definition of what Theseus's ship is. Okay, but this has nothing to do about ships. I'm not interested in ships. Everything has this. WBAI over the years changes. I mean, they're still 99.5, but they've changed. Their hosts change. Their audience change. Their owners change. Everything about it changes. Harry Allen changes over the years. Every cell in your body has died in the past 7 years. So what makes you the same person as you were 7 years ago? I've changed. Everybody's changed, physical change. So we can ask the following question. What makes Harry Allen Harry Allen? What characteristics are about him that he has?
Because 7 years ago, it was materially a different body. It didn't just look different. It wasn't just more fit 7 years ago. 7 years ago, it was actually different cells.
It was actually different.
And the cells I'm made of now didn't exist 7 years
right.
ago. So the question is, who am I? Yeah.
Who are you?
Hmm.
Okay. Now, this is not a, you know, type of self-referential problem. This is a question and at the heart of philosophy, namely, what's going on here? We have physical objects, but we don't have clear definitions of what they are. Okay? And so what makes the ship of Theseus the ship of Theseus? What makes Harry Allen Harry Allen? What makes WBAI WBAI? And these are unanswerable questions. I mean, there's no clear answer to any of these things.
In chapter 3, which is called Philosophical Conundrums, in which you address this, you also talk about vagueness and the boldness paradox.
The bold man paradox.
Bold man paradox. Yes,
right.
yes.
So,
and how does that work, please?
So you know, the point is the notion of boldness is somehow vague. If a person has, you know, no hair, he's clearly bald. If you remember in Archie Comics, Mr. Weatherby has three hairs coming up. But I think we can call him, you know, bald also.
Right.
Telly Savalas is bald. Okay, but the point is the boundary between when someone's bald and when someone's not bald is not exactly clear. So, again, what's the definition of bald?
Right.
But it has nothing, again, this has nothing to do with bold. We could talk about tallness. Okay. If I say he is over 6 feet tall, that's a clear mathematical statement. That's an exact statement. If I say he is tall, relative to who?
Yeah.
Compared to what? You know, and so the notion of tall, again, this is a notion that we work with every day and we deal with it every day, but it's not clear. They don't have exact definitions for these things.
This is something I've thought about and tried to even see if there's an answer to about the question of when does speech become singing?
Interesting.
Like if you start talking and then as you're talking, you go into what's called a sing-song voice. That means it's not quite singing, but it's not quite speaking. And then eventually you start to sing. You see this in movies and musicals all the time, this actual...
And poetry is somewhere in between there.
Yes.
Exactly.
So when is it speaking and when is it singing?
Right. When is it prose and when is it poetry?
Right. Yes. Exactly.
So the point is that there are many concepts that do not have solid definitions.
And that's this vagueness issue that you speak to.
Right.
In your chapter on computing complexities, which is number 5 in the book, you discuss the traveling salesman problem. And what is that, actually?
This is an amazing, simple problem that I can explain to any third grader, and it's easy to understand. So, and yet, you'll see, it really doesn't, it's not that simple. Okay. a man or a woman wants to go to 7 different cities, and he knows which cities he wants to go to, but he wants to go to the shortest possible path. So how does he find out what the shortest possible path is?
The shortest route going to each of the cities,
going to each of the cities exactly once. Well, it turns out that for 7 cities, it's very simple. It's easy to do. You have to try every possible route and measure how long it would take him, and then take the smallest of those. Okay. Now, it turns out that there's 720 possible routes for 7 cities. It's not hard to show. Okay, good. Now, let's say I don't want to do 7. I want to do 100 cities. Okay. Now, for a computer to figure out 7 cities, it would take approximately 2 seconds to go through all 720 routes. Nowadays, computers are so fast, so amazing, that they can do it in a second or 2 seconds flat. Question: how long would it take a computer to figure out the shortest possible route if he wanted to go to 100 cities? And this is not a strange question. In the movie Up in the Air with that guy that looks like me, George Clooney.
He does, folks. He looks exactly like George.
It's radio. In the movie Up in the Air, George Clooney goes around to 100 different cities a year. Let's say he wanted to go to the shortest possible path, okay? And he wanted to hit every one of these cities exactly once. Well, so that's a typical question. It's not a strange question. You want to hit every one of the 100 most populated cities in the United States, and you want to hit them once, and you want the shortest possible path. Okay, how long would it take a computer? Well, I show in the book that even if you have a computer that can check, let's say, 1 million routes in a second, it would take 2 point something with 140 zeros after it, centuries. Not hours, not minutes, not years, centuries. Which means it cannot be done by a computer. Now, whenever I teach this, I always get, students jumping up and saying, yeah, but I have an Apple computer. My computer can do it. No, it's not doable by any computer. And I even say in the thing, physicists tell us that there is 10 to the 80 number of particles in the universe. If every one of those particles was a computer working on this problem, it would still take trillions and trillions of centuries to do. So this is a problem for which there's an objective answer. There is an objective answer. There is a shortest path. I just don't know it. There is an objective answer to this question, and yet we will never be able to figure it out.
Is the number that you of routes represented by the factorial of the number of
100 factorial? So that's 100 times 99 times 98 times 97 ... all the way down to 1. Now notice every time you do that times 90, you're multiplying it by 2 digits, so you're making that number 2 digits longer. That's a humongous number. And we were talking before about trying to go through finding the shortest route that hits every single New York City subway station.
Okay. Yes.
Now, you said there were 700 subway stations?
It's about 700 and something. I can't remember what the exact number is.
That's way, way larger than 100. And that would take way, way, way... So that's a simple, obvious question for which there's an objective answer. What's the shortest way to hit every single subway station? And yet, no computer, no human being, no humongous connection of all computers will ever be able to answer that.
There's
question.
A club that does that. They do the computation this way. They have members whose job it is to ride around the subway, and whoever can hit every station in the fastest amount of time. But they're just doing it off of feel,
right.
and what they think they know about how the lines run and things like that. But that's not an actual brute force calculation at all.
And what they're doing is they're competing against each other, and the one who gets the quickest, he or she wins, but that doesn't mean that it's the shortest. We're looking for the shortest of all possible routes.
Mm.
But in order to calculate all possible routes, you'll need 700 factorial. That's 700 times 699 times 698 times 6. That's just humongous, humongous.
And factorial, for those who know, that would be the number 700 with an exclamation point after
it.
That's what factorial looks like. And it means, I've been meaning to I've been wanting to talk about factorials to young people at my church. And I was trying to figure out what's a meaningful kind of thing to embrace. And that's it.
Yeah. No, the point is that it grows very, very quickly.
Exceedingly rapidly. Yes, okay. yes, indeed. The book closes with a chapter called Beyond Reason. And so what is that about?
So, you know, after 10 chapters of going through all this stuff, I try to categorize it and say, okay, so all the chapters are different areas, computers, philosophy, science, math, and things like that. But I try to categorize it in different ways. And so what I get is I get a four-way categorization. In other words, every limitation that's described in the book can be described in one of four ways. And one of them is infeasibility. In other words, a lot of the, like this traveling salesman problem is an example of infeasibility. Not that we cannot get the answer, just it's infeasible to get the answer. In other words, I can take a computer and have it run trillions and trillions and trillions and trillions of centuries and I'll get the answer, but it's infeasible. Figuring out tomorrow's lottery number. I can keep track of where all the atoms are in the balls, you know, that have it, and I'd be able to figure out what tomorrow's lottery numbers are.
And if you could calculate all the forces acting on it,
exactly,
and everything like that.
Hmm. But it's infeasible to do that. I can't do that. It's just infeasible. Again, so there's an answer. And then there's three other categories of these things that
these issues of what science and mathematics and reason can't tell us.
Right. But the amazing thing is that although these things are in different areas, computers, logic, math, science, Gödel's incompleteness theorem, whatever, although they're
Gödel,
many different areas, but I'm able to summarize them all four into these four limitations. But even Gödel, we mentioned Gödel, so it's worth saying, Gödel is an example of the self-referential limitation. Gödel was this amazing, amazing genius who lived, you know, till the 70s. He was a friend of Einstein.
He used to take walks together.
Right. Einstein used to say that he used to go from his house to the Institute just so they can walk Gödel home. Although Gödel was 20 years younger than him, he was so impressed with Gödel that he would do that. Anyways, Gödel showed...
And Gödel didn't die well.
No.
Yeah, he didn't die well. He was brilliant, but his mind went...
Although I just, we'll talk about Turing in a second. Yeah. But what Turing was able to do was show that mathematics can talk about it.
Well, Gödel was able to do it, or Turing?
They both died not well.
Okay, yeah. You said that Turing was able to do was show that mathematics, you meant Gödel.
No, I'm sorry. Gödel was able to do was to show that mathematics was self-referential.
Yes.
And so he, instead of finding a sentence in mathematics that says, I am false, that's not a good idea, but he found a sentence in mathematics that says, I am unprovable. Okay, now what happens there? I am unprovable. Well, that statement is then true, but unprovable. If it's true, it's true and unprovable. Well, that means that there are certain things in mathematics that are true, but not provable. A typical mathematician says, oh, whatever's true, he can prove it. He can sit down and she can write up a long proof and it's provable. And Gödel said, no. Using this same self-reference as Epimenides, yeah, that same idea pops up, and he shows, no, there are certain things that are true, but they can't be proved.
And he showed it with a proof.
And he showed it with a proof. Like, that's what I was saying. All these results are scientific mathematical proofs, and they're not intuitions. This is the greatest logician since Aristotle showing the limits of logic.
Why did that blow people's minds, especially mathematicians' minds?
Because mathematicians all thought that whatever is true, they can actually prove. And this shows that it can't. And I go further in my book. I show it's not only, you know, Gödel's strange sentence, you know, this sentence is unprovable. The vast majority of mathematical true statements cannot be proven.
There's a mathematical proof of that.
That's a mathematical statement, a mathematical proof of it. So that puts limitations on what mathematicians can do.
Are the number of mathematical statements infinite?
Infinite. Okay, so we have there.
So when you say vast majority, what are we talking about?
Well, that's a good point. But it can be technically formulated. So, for example, take the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The vast majority of them, they're all infinite, but the vast majority of them are not prime numbers.
Right.
Right. So I can talk about vast majority of things, even though the prime numbers are infinite, the non-prime numbers are infinite, but the vast majority of them are not infinite.
Is there a what is the relationship of the ideas in this book to what the average person who's not a mathematician, a logician, a physicist, what is the implication of these ideas for regular people, do you think?
I think everybody's interested in what science, you know, somebody told me that the most popular day that the New York Times sold is the Science Times Tuesday. That's, you know, by me the most, you know, popular thing, but I think most people are just interested in what science can tell us and what's going on out there, even though it doesn't affect their life, you know. It doesn't have a major effect. People are interested in what can be known, what cannot be known. People are interested in what computers can do. And, you know, everybody, the minute you get a new computer, the first thing you think of, oh, I got to get the newest one because that has this and this feature. So you're always interested in what's the latest thing. And this is even more interesting in the sense that this shows, again, what can't be done, what's beyond it. So I think most people are interested in such things.
I think it might also help individuals understand the limits of promises that they are made by powerful people. I think that oftentimes there are people in power make assertions or make projections or make promises that cannot be held. And right. They may not come under the things in this book, but I think that if you understand that there are limits, functional limits to human knowledge, reason, etc., it can help you to have maybe a more precise way of speaking or thinking, or at least suspect to a certain degree of what you're told as official knowledge, perhaps.
I agree. I mean, right. I'm not pushing down science.
Yes.
It's an amazing... In chapter 7, I was dealing with quantum mechanics and relativity theory. Quantum mechanics and relativity theory are relatively new things from 1905 on, and the world changed so much from 1905 on. I mean, we didn't have a concept of a microwave. We didn't have, you know, people didn't know what a galaxy was. A galaxy was thought, every star was thought to be a star, but now we see that no, the stars are actually galaxies. So, you know, our world has changed so much, and yet we have limitations. We have things that we cannot know, and so it's an amazing thing.
The book is called The Outer Limits of Reason. It has a really cool cover, and it's on the MIT Press. It's by Nussin Yanofsky, who's been our guest today, Nussin S. Yanofsky. He is a professor of computer science at Brooklyn College here in New York. The subtitle for this book, What Science, Mathematics, and Logic Cannot Tell Us. And it's a great read, and it's an enduring read, I think. I think this is probably a book that's going to be true for trillions of years, wouldn't you say?
I hope so.
Dr. Yanofsky, thanks so much for being our guest today on Nonfiction and on WBAI.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
And that'll bring this week's edition of Nonfiction to a close. We want to thank our guest, Dr. Nussin Yanofsky, for his ideas and insights. Nonfiction is a co-production of both the Arts Department at WBAI and of Media Assassin. Read the Media Assassin blog at harryallen.info for news about upcoming shows and information. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. Additional production was provided by Jeff Snyder, Grand Mixer DXT, and Harry Allen. Special thanks to Zakiya D. McGregor, Kiko Nosferatu, the staff and volunteers at WBAI, but most of all to you, our listeners, members, and supporters, without whom none of this would be possible. A 99.5 FM would be bound to live in the village where everyone gets their hair cut by the barber, except the barber, well, you know how it goes. No doubt set in that village by the evil Clear Channel Corporation. Please continue to support WBAI with your donations and gifts. Email us at nonfictionradio@yahoo.com. That's nonfictionradio@yahoo.com. Follow me at Harry Allen on Twitter. That's at Harry Allen. Up next, Howard Jordan and the Jordan Journal. For Nonfiction, I'm your producer and host, Harry Allen, wishing you an excellent and blessed week. We'll be right back.
Hello, people. This is Howard Jordan of the Jordan Journal. And every Friday from 3 to 5 p.m., we will be providing you with the utmost coverage of the issues of the day. Every Friday from 3 to 5 p.m. Stay tuned. Listen to the Jordan Journal and don't forget to make a donation to the station. And like I tell you every week, God loves you and I do too.
Imhotep Gary Bird inviting you to join us for Radio GBE, the Global Black Experience and the Global Beat Experience, where the message is in the music, Friday nights, 6 to 8 p.m. Join us for all the features, interviews, guest coverage, and the music mix you've come to expect, and, of course, the things that light up your Friday night here in New York City and across the country and right through the diaspora. Pass the word, Bird is flying high in the New York sky with Radio GBE, radio in the key of life, Friday nights, 6 to 8 p.m. right here on WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
This is Dr. Ron Daniels, president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, inviting you to participate in a national international reparations summit, April 9th through the 11th in New York, with Professor Hillary Beckles, representatives of the CARICOM's Reparations Commission, and reparations advocates from the Caribbean, Central and South America, Canada, and Europe. Join us for a welcome rally at Mother AME Zion Church in Harlem, a benefit tribute to Congressman John Conyers with keynote speaker Danny Glover, hosted by 1199, and a climatic closing rally at First AME Zion Church in Brooklyn. Join us in welcoming our sisters and brothers from the Pan-African world for this historic Reparations Summit, April 9th through the 11th in New York. For the full schedule and program, visit the website ibw21.org. That's ibw21.org or call 718-429-1415. That's 718-429-1415.
The Pacifica Radio Archive celebrates Women's History Month.
I am willing to answer all questions about myself. I have nothing to hide from your committee. I am not willing, now or in the future, to bring bad trouble to people who in my past association with them were completely innocent of any talk or any action that was disloyal or subversive.
American playwright Lillian Hellman reads her 1950 letter to the House Un-American Activities Committee, HUAC. Part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, American Women Making History and Culture, 1963 to 1982. Funded in part by a grant from the National Historical Publications and Records Commission at the National Archives and Records Administration. For more information, visit us at PacificaRadioArchives.org. I'm Donna Walker. Thanks for keeping our women's history alive.
Saturday, March 28th, come to the premiere of the new film, Revolution and Religion, The Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion. 1,900 people witnessed this historic dialogue at the Riverside Church between Cornel West and Bob Avakian, infused with fire and passion to bring to an end all forms of oppression. Now see the film, March 28th, 4 to 9 p.m. at the Schomburg Center for Black Culture, 515 Malcolm X Boulevard in Harlem. For tickets and information, call Revolution Books, 212-691-3345, or visit revolutionbooksnyc.org.
Free Mumia Abu Jamal Coalition invites you to a showing of the documentary Let the Fire Burn, about Philadelphia's firebombing.